this week's edition of the Great American Hockey Show podcast. Murph, when it hits June, what do we talk about after the Stanley Cup on the hockey calendar? All about the draft.
Yeah, all about the draft and what has become trade deadline part two, if not part one, because I think it's bigger than the trade deadline. And we could see a lot of movement this year, especially with the expansion draft coming in next year. It's going to be an exciting next 2 to 3 to 4 weeks of player movement, I think, in the NHL.
Yeah, well, the hot stove is burning as far as hockey goes. I'm going to talk draft prospects with Kirk Ledoukhi, a guy that knows everything about the Bruins prospects.
Yep.
And certainly knows a ton about these kids that are going to hear their names called at the end of June in Buffalo. So let's get cranked with the Great American Hockey Show. Let the summer cooler edition of the Great American Hockey Show podcast begin. James Murphy, we talked about her online anyway on Twitter. Ian McCaution from the Boston College Eagles going to sign with the Florida Panthers, leave school early. That was the latest news that we broke. Anything else that you're hearing rumor-wise? Anything in the rumor mill coming down the pipe?
I mean, nothing specific to the Bruins. Just, you know, obviously still trying to move the contract to Dennis Seidenberg, but no updates whatsoever, really. But in terms of league-wide, I mean, I know that the Detroit Red Wings would love to really unload Datsyuk's contract, Pavel Datsyuk, and Arizona has had some talks with them there. Carolina would be a great candidate, but from what I'm told, there is such bad blood between the two owners there, Peter Karmanos in Carolina and Mike Ilitch in Detroit, that might prevent that from happening. But connecting this back to the Bruins, Joe, and we've seen this happen already with some unwanted contracts being moved and what the team moving them has to do, you know, throw in a second-round pick or this or that.
Or Teravainen,
yeah, exactly.
The Chicago Blackhawks.
Exactly, right. So yeah. They wanted to unload Bickle there, but they had to throw in Timo Teravainen there. And, yep. You know, I think I think it's Teravainen, right?
Teravainen.
Yeah, Teravainen. We got it. I just want to give him credit. I like the Finns, you know. But, you know, I think that's what the Bruins might have to do in order to unload Seidenberg's contract. They might have to sweeten the pot with a second rounder or third rounder or something attractive to that team that's taking on that contract, because that's the way it's going right now in the NHL.
Yeah, and it wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing either. I think part of what Chicago is doing there as well, when they move a player like Teravainen, is moving a player that could potentially get plucked in an expansion draft anyway. You know,
yeah.
And I think a lot of the NHL teams are prepping that as well, moving roster players or guys that have experience.
We definitely should discuss that.
And they're moving players that might get taken in the expansion draft and getting draft picks back in return. They're going to be protected, and you're not going to have to worry about protecting them when the expansion draft happens. And I think this is everybody's been focusing on the salary cap with the Bickle deal. I think the expansion draft has as much to do with it and trading away players that you might lose anyway. I mean, when you do the exercise and you look at the Boston Bruins and what they might lose potentially in an expansion draft, you might lose Colin Miller. You might lose a player like Ryan Spooner. You're talking about maybe losing players that have significant trade value in that kind of a draft. Why not think about moving somebody like that now and getting an asset back in return before you're left empty-handed and lose them for nothing when it gets to that point? That's why you might hear a name like Ryan Spooner packaged together with a Dennis Seidenberg if they do try to move his contract.
That's a great point there, Joe. And, you know, look, I know that the Bruins management has taken a lot of PR hits over the past year, and they're kind of getting beaten up on the chat rooms on the internet right now. But I give credit to Don Sweeney, and I don't know if you remember this, Joe, when him and Julian spoke at the end of the year, and then they broke off into the sort of scrum with us. Mm-hmm. You were there. You were right next to me, I believe. He, without even being prompted, brought up, hey, we have to factor in what's going to happen with the expansion draft, and we're looking at that right now, too. He was the first GM I have heard, and I'm sure they were already doing it, but, I mean, he was the first one to publicly acknowledge that and say, you know what? There's a lot more we have to factor in here. This isn't just about now. This is about next year. And that's a great observation by you. And I think the Bruins are looking at that right now. And I think that's definitely going to factor into any moves they make.
Yeah, and I do think if they do have to move a defenseman, I don't think they're going to be able to move Dennis Seidenberg, though, at the end of the day. I think that's going to be difficult. I think Adam McQuaid might be the guy that ended up moved. I think somebody is going to get moved, because you can't have Adam McQuaid and Kevin Miller making $5.2 million per year for the next 3 or 4
when
years.
Basically the same
when
guy.
You combine the two of them. As one NHL executive said to me, you have two number six defensemen on your team, you can't win.
Yeah.
You know, if you have two guys like that in your top six that you're paying that kind of money to, you can't win.
We're just going
to
call it like the Adam Miller monster.
Yeah. Kevin McQuaid.
Yeah.
League-wide, though, Jacob Trouba, I think, has been at the heart of a lot of rumors. I had heard Colorado Avalanche with him, Matt Duchene, was the name that I had heard potentially.
Which tells you what,
betting,
Joe,
thrown
when it comes
around,
back to the Bruins.
That they don't have the guns and the artillery to get it done.
They're not even close.
This is the thing. Matt Duchene is the name that you heard potentially going to Winnipeg for Jacob Trouba.
Uh-huh.
Edmonton, you heard Taylor Hall and Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. Especially if Peter Chiarelli drafts Matthew Tkachuk and has a young player that can step in and fill for Taylor Hall and you trade away the veteran. What do the Bruins have that they can offer that anywhere approaches that? I mean, people will say, what about David Krejci? I don't want a 30-year-old David Krejci who's been injury-prone and on the downside of his career. He does not compare to Matt Duchene and Ryan Nugent-Hopkins and Taylor Hall. That tells me that the Bruins don't have a shot at Jacob Trouba, Hampus Lindholm, you know, players like that, those young D that are RFAs that are going to really get paid this summer. Kevin Shattenkirk is probably the only guy I think they have a legitimate chance to get via trade. And then you're looking at Keith Yandel in free agency or Alex Goligoski if he doesn't sign with the Coyotes.
And you know, you bring up the David Krejci as a trade chip there. I can't say the team right now, but I know for a fact that he was already – in a trade package offered to another team, and that team rejected it for the reasons you just said. So right away, that just shows you where his value is on the trade market. You look at Minnesota, Jonas Brodin was a name that we had heard a lot, and I think both of you and I reported way back. And you look at Minnesota right now, Joe, Derek Stepan is a guy that now all of a sudden is out there on the trade market because of cap issues in New York, and the Rangers might be forced to move him because of that and because of the expansion draft coming up. Like you said, Minnesota's a team that's been rumored to always been interested in Stepan because he's a hometown kid there, and Brodin would be the perfect guy to go there. So there's another defenseman that might go off the market there. The Bruins just don't have what it takes to get the guys they're targeting right now, and I think, you know, that's a harsh reality that over the next month, Bruins fans are going to realize.
Yeah, and something tells me when it all ends for the Bruins and when the dust settles after July 1, they're going to end up with Keith Yandel. I just have a feeling they're going to sign him. Obviously, he's a top four guy. He's a guy that can play 20 minutes a night, move the puck, good on the power play. There's a lot of ways that Keith Yandel can help that Boston Bruins team. But he's also a left shot. He's not the perfect fit for exactly what they need or what they're looking for.
He's certainly not the best in his own end.
No, certainly wouldn't be a partner for Zdeno Chara on a top pairing.
He's the anti-Claude, you know? Julien.
Yeah. Well, and that's the other thing. Is there's some, like, you know, I have a feeling we'd see a lot of the same things that we saw with Dennis Wiedemann when he was here with Claude Julien. Some of the problems that Claude Julien had with Wiedemann, if there was a guy like Yandel's a better player, but I think
and
it would
Yandel's
be
a better guy in the dressing room.
Right. But Yandel's a high-risk player offensively, and I think Claude always has trouble with those kind of players. So that will be interesting. They're going to do something. I think fans have developed a heightened over-awareness of the need and think that these young defensemen are going to be easy to get. And I just want to give a reality check that some of the names that are being mentioned out there are things that the Bruins can't compete with, and they're just not going to have the trade collateral to get one of those young D.
Now, Joe, you know, as we've mentioned before,
Tyson Barrie's another one, too, that's in the Trouba, Hampus Lindholm.
We've mentioned before, though, that, well, Tyson Barrie, Sakic said he's willing to take his arbitration deal.
We'll see, though.
We'll see. That might just be negotiating stuff there.
Right.
But, you know, Joe, we look at it right now with their picks, and we're hearing, you know, obviously the 29th pick would be the pick that they'd be more likely to move. You know, would they ever consider to get that defenseman packaging in the number 14? I don't know.
I don't think so. I think they like – I agree with Kirk Ledecky, who we're going to have on a little bit later, and I've read a lot of his stuff, and he's very high on Dante Fabbro. Maybe we'll hear that in the interview. But I also am high on the kid. I like the interview I had with him and talking to him. Very personable and real, genuine when you talk to him at the draft. just about all kinds of different subjects. And I think he had a good self-awareness to him in his game. And he was a bigger kid, and he's skilled, obviously. I think they like him enough that they're not going to trade away a chance to pick him at 14. They're not going to, like, move up to get a guy like that. I think 14 is a great spot for him to be in. But I think they like that. They're much more prone to give up the 29 pick and a Ryan Spooner, so, or maybe even a Torrey Krug if they don't want to pay him $5 million a year. I think that's something that might also be a consideration for them. But that's not enough to get it done for one of these young defensemen.
So if Joe Sakic came to – you're Don Sweeney right now. Yeah. Joe Sakic comes to you and says, look, I'm going to give you my first-round pick and Tyson Barry for your first-round pick and let's just say David Krejci. Mm-hmm. You don't do it?
Why would you? Well,
I don't think Colorado would do that. I'm just saying.
Why? Where was their first round pick? Well, their first round pick's ahead of the Bruins, though. They would.
Yeah,
they would. Of course,
I
they
know.
Would do that.
Yeah.
If they could trade up and get a different player and a better first round pick. My point is, why trade for a Tyson Barry if you're the Bruins in the situation that they're in? If you can draft a Tyson Barry and then have him on an entry level deal,
because I think there's a division in terms of where the team's going within management.
Maybe, but I'm going to live in.
I'm
going to live in a perfect world where the Bruins do the right thing.
Yeah,
for the long term health and well being of the organization. I hope everybody out there listening does as well. And let's leave with that happy thought. I'm going to let the people know they can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or most podcast apps by searching for CSNNE. Go to csnne.com/podcast. And I also urge fans to leave a rating and review on iTunes if you like the show. Make sure to check out all of our csnne.com insiders on some of the other podcasts. All right, we're glad to bring in Kirk Ledecky from Kirk. Remind us of the different entities that you write for, because I know there's multiples, and I don't want to leave anybody out.
Yeah, I Redline Report, the independent scouting service. See ourselves kind of as the unofficial 31st team, and we all teams subscribe to our service, and we provide a ranking of players just like an NHL team would. So we're not trying to be predictive of the draft, just trying to rate the players 1 to 300 some odd, you know, how we would draft them if we were a team participating in the process. And then New England Hockey Journal, been doing that for 16 years now, working as the Bruins and prospects and draft analyst for them. And then I have my own blog, thescoutingpost.com, where I just kind of use that as an outlet to, you know, talk about hockey and, you know, say what's on my mind. So I stay pretty busy. Thanks.
And I was waiting for you to start your own blog. I know you've done that within the last couple of years.
Oh, that's great.
And it's fantastic. And you have so much information to give, even the stuff that you don't end up in a story with, that I thought it's a great outlet for the leftovers, so to speak, that you have, or something that you really want to talk about that you don't necessarily put in a feature.
Yeah, well, you know what really did it was the change in format that the New England Hockey Journal went to. You know, we used to have a website, and we would supplement our writing and the articles that we published in the monthly print magazine on the website. But then New England Hockey Journal shifted focus, went to a television show, and the print focus be on the print. And so there's no longer a website with supplemental articles on it. It's just, you know, you go and you can read the print edition in digital format. So that's really what kind of opened my eyes to doing my own blog. And, you know, it's been a nice opportunity, and I'm kind of glad to have an outlet for my writing. So I appreciate the kind words, guys.
So with that in mind, just looking forward, the draft's less than a couple of weeks away. For Bruins fans, for people that are interested sort of provincially in the black and gold, two first-round picks, 14 and 29, what do you kind of forecast as some of the names to look out for that you think the Bruins may target and would fit needs for them in their organization?
Yeah, the thing about this draft is that it's really quality on the high end, and depending on who you talk to, I think that quality extends past 15. So the Bruins are in a pretty good spot. A big difference from a year ago is that there are a lot of forwards that are really highly regarded in this draft, which, you know, a year ago the Bruins were looking at trying to get one of those high-end defensemen that were all projected in the top 10. And, of course, I'm talking about Noah Hanifin, Ivan Provorov, and Zach Werenski, and that's exactly how it fell out. They were all gone by the time Boston's pick came around, and there were rumors, of course, and some pretty solid reporting that they had tried to move into that top 10 to get one of those guys. This year, it looks like if they really are looking at a defenseman, and that player happens to be the best available player value at 14, they're probably going to get him. Because regardless if you're talking about a Dante Fabro or a Jake Bean or a Charlie McAvoy, even if one of those players comes off the board earlier than expected, or other forwards are drafted earlier than expected, it means someone unexpected will probably drop to the Bruins, and whether that's a defenseman or a forward is anyone's guess. Now, the 29th pick, that's a little harder to peg. Unfortunately for the Bruins, it was 18 until San Jose went on their run, so now they're picking 29. So I would be kind of surprised if they held the pick. I could see them maybe thinking about moving it for some, you know, to get into the early second round, get an extra second rounder and maybe a fourth, or maybe moving it as part of a package for an NHLD. But if they hold on to it, I could see them maybe trying to get, if they're looking at maybe a forward, this Wade Allison kid out of the USHL for the Tri-City Storm was the USHL playoff MVP, and he's a real heavy, skilled, power winger headed to the Western Michigan University Broncos, and he's also kind of a character kid. I mean, you watch him interviewed, he's really mature, and to me that kind of screams Bruins, and I just keep going back to what Cam Neely said a few weeks ago about wanting to get heavier on the right wing. Now, he's not projected as a first-round pick, but he just went white-hot in the second half of the season, and he's one of these classic risers, kind of like Zach Sinishin a year ago, where it maybe took the scouting services a little longer to catch up to him, but an NHL team might grab him. But honestly, I'll be surprised if the Bruins hold on to both firsts, guys.
Yeah, in talking to people at the Combine, in talking to some of those kids that you just mentioned, Dante Fabro, I had one talent evaluator compare him very favorably to Kevin Shattenkirk at the same level of development before he went to Boston University. Of course, the puck-moving Fabro will be going to BU starting next year. Charlie McAvoy, a really solid two-way guy, plays in all situations at BU and had an outstanding season for BU last year as a freshman, a true freshman, in a really, you know, a difficult league to compete in for kids that age. And then Jake Bean, the one thing that I was told was that his shot is phenomenal, and that's kind of his calling card. I think he had 24 goals last year. Maybe a little bit about each of them, because I feel like if things go according to Hoyle, one of those guys is going to be the pick for the Bruins at 14.
Okay, so if I was sitting on a staff, if an NHL team hired me and I'm sitting there at 14 and Dante Fabro's on the board, I'm pounding the table. He's my guy. Love Dante Fabro. I can't say enough about the kid. I'll phrase it the way an NHL scout did for me when I was asking him about him not too long ago, and I had this in my blog, and if fans are unfamiliar with Dante Fabro, I encourage them to go to scoutingpost.com, and they can see a really in-depth profile. And if you look at what the kid's saying, it's pretty remarkable and mature for someone his age. But the scout told me, he said, set aside the talent for a second, because it's so impressive. We're talking about a kid that just processes the game at such an elite level, and that's so important in the modern NHL. Really good skater. He doesn't have that ideal, you know, massive size, but when we talk ideal size, and we're talking, you know, in the modern NHL, they like their defensemen to be 6'3", 6'4", 6'5", and, you know, they want them to be able to skate. He's closer to 6'1", and I've stood next to him in gear and out of gear, and his size is fine. He's, you know, we're not talking about an undersized guy. He's not big, but I think he's bigger than he gets credit for. He said, set all that stuff aside for a second and look at the way he competes. He just, you know, moves his feet constantly, hustles, works extremely hard in all zones, and then when you talk to the kid, you're just blown away at his maturity and his outlook. This is someone who, you know, I interview a lot of these kids every year for 16 years now, and some of them are just very scripted, and they're not genuine, and you can kind of tell because they're young, and they're kind of, you can tell when they're just kind of telling you what you want to hear or what an agent or a coach has kind of told them to say, and it's kind of the party line. And when you talk to a kid like Dante Fabro, it's just, I mean, he talks with conviction. And you get the sense that he's not telling you what you want to hear. He's telling you what he believes. And he's the type of kid that does what he says he's going to do. So I see him less as a Kevin Shattenkirk and more as a Duncan Keith potential. And, you know, you hate to put that level of pressure on a guy.
Yeah.
But the reality is Duncan Keith, you know, he's not a guy that's got this massive shot and is going out and scoring goals all the time. But he's eating tons of minutes. He's playing in all situations. And then at the end of the night, he's got three assists, you know, and has just played in all situations. And he's just the, you know, he's the straw that stirs the drink defensively on the Chicago Blackhawks. And that's what the kind of player Dante Fabbro could be. Now, Charlie McAvoy, I really like him a lot. I think he is more offensively inclined at the next level potentially than Fabbro, just because he's a player that just pushes the pace offensively and puts defenses on their heels. He'll grab the puck and go. He can you know, move. He's got that four-way mobility, the speed. You know, he's quick burst, quick short area burst. You know, he's got separation speed in the open ice, and he's aggressive. He's not afraid to take the puck and wheel it deep and take it himself and do all those things. Now, having said that, sometimes he gets a little bit in trouble because he will aggressively decide to go deep, chase the puck in, or carry the puck in, and he plays at such a high pace that sometimes his teammates are a little slower to get back into position to cover him, and then I've seen some offensive chances go the other way. So I think sometimes McAvoy needs to maybe slow his decisions down a little bit and maybe dial it back a notch, and that will come with experience. He's kind of learn how to recognize when he's got the openings and when he needs to maybe be a little more conservative in his approach. But I know David Quinn likes him a lot. I had a talk with Coach Quinn in Grand Forks. He was there at the under-18s to see his four high-end BU recruits, and actually five if you include the USA goalie that's going to be there next year. And he's very excited about those players. Finally, Jake Bean, yeah, you're right, 24 goals as a defenseman in the WHL. That's phenomenal. His coach, Mark French, described it as a sneaky wrist shot. Comes off the stick. You know, he hides his release point so goalies don't know when it's coming. It's like the seeing eye pucks. You know, he's able to shoot it through traffic. Just really heady player, really offensively inclined. And his coach thinks that Bean doesn't get enough credit for his defense, that he's better defensively. People focus on the offense. Unfortunately for me, I didn't get to see Bean play live because he took a shot off the foot in the last exhibition game, and he was unable to play for Canada at the under-18s. But he might have been a difference maker in terms of them getting a medal versus you know, finishing fourth. So those guys, yeah, I think all three make sense. But if you had to ask me personally, you know, who I'd go with, it's Fabbro and then McAvoy and Bean, and it's a coin flip between all three because they're very close.
Kirk, you talked about Fabbro there and how you know, reading him, you can see he's sincere and it's not just agent speak that he's given you there. How important, on that note, how important have these player interviews become over the years that the GMs, the scouts are able to do around the combine, after the combine, leading into the draft? And how much of that has, in your eyes, maybe swayed decisions as they get closer to the draft, where, you know, maybe a guy has had, maybe a team has had a player really high on their charts and really the guy they're targeting, but then they sit down with him and they're like, you know, I don't know about this anymore. Is that happening more often now? Are GMs, are scouts paying more attention to the person as opposed to just the skills?
I think so. I mean, if you go back to the old days, you didn't have a salary cap. And player development was not as advanced as it is now. You didn't have advanced statistics. I go back to, and I know you guys are around, you know, we're all around the same age, so I go back to 1989. The Bruins drafted a guy named Shane Stevenson. You guys remember that name?
Yeah.
Now, Shane Stevenson was one of these players who was all tools and then ultimately no toolbox. But at the time, Stevenson was at one point, you know, being considered like a top five, top three draft pick in his draft year. This is like the first year he was in the OHL. People were very excited about him because Cam Neely was just starting to really blossom as a Hall of Fame right wing for the Bruins at that time. And Shane Stevenson carried similar kind of style and promise as a big, rugged, skilled winger who could skate and bang and score. The problem with Stevenson was he had some real personal off-ice issues that the Bruins, from what I've understood in my research over the years, were aware of, but they drafted him anyway because they were picking near the bottom of the round, and that's why one of the reasons he slipped, because his issues were kind of known. And ultimately, they didn't. When he joined the Bruins, it was a very veteran team. There weren't many young guys. We're talking about the Ray Bourque, Andy Moog,
right.
Craig Janney, Glenn Wesley era of the Bruins, and there just weren't many young guys on that team. So a guy like Shane Stephenson just kind of was left to his own devices and didn't really have many friends, and there were no player development guys to kind of take these guys under their wing, and unfortunately for him, he fell out of the Bruins, went to the Lightning, and then was out of the NHL, and then was really on the lower end of the minor leagues, and was kind of a cautionary tale of a failed first-round pick. Now, the reason I bring that up is, back then, what price did the Bruins pay? Well, not much, because, well, he just didn't work out.
Right.
But nowadays, teams, because the salary cap is in place, and because they have so much money invested on the top end of their salary structure and their veterans, they've got to have success at the draft, and they've got to have these cost-controlled, lower-end, entry-level contracts with impactful young players that can offset that and give them room to breathe and allow them to ice the best possible team with depth. And that's the challenge, and that's why NHL teams have to pay more attention to the character of their kids, and they have to decide. And it's more than that, Murph and Hags. You know, these guys are ambassadors. You guys are around the team. You see all the fundraising, charity events that they go to. They want the character guys that are going to, A, represent the team in fine fashion to the fans and interact with their fans as ambassadors. But they also want guys that are going to have the character to want to do that. And so ultimately it comes down to, you know, they're not going to draft a guy just because he has a good character, but that's definitely a bonus. So I look at a guy like Fabro, and I know that the skeptics might say, oh, well, you know, Lüdecke likes the character guys. And I do. I admit that. That's something that matters to me when I do my own player evaluation. I talk to the kids, and I try to get a measure of their character while they're playing the game. So there's in-game character and then the off-ice character. But when it comes to a player like Dante Fabro, for example, I mean, he's the whole package. I mean, he can flat out play. He's one of the more skilled defensemen. I think he gets a bum rap because people point to the BCHL and kind of diminish him a little bit.
Right.
And I think there's nothing to that, Hags. I mean, if you look at the way he played in the under-18s, he was a dominant defenseman, was arguably the best defenseman in the entire tournament, and arguably, you know, top three, top five players of any position in the whole under-18 tournament. Okay, so it's not a BCHL thing. And then, you just bring in the character and the commitment and the drive and the self-motivation and all of that, and you say, this is a guy that one day is, you know, not only going to play in the NHL, but he's probably going to have a letter on his sweater.
And just continuing on this theme quickly, in terms of evaluating the personality, I mean, like you said, we've got the stats available, we've got scouts at games, but is that put more of an emphasis on having really strong scouts over in Europe and really being able to get these to know some of these players off the ice as well? Because, I mean, I think of a Radulov, right? You know, would this guy have gone as high as he did in the draft next week, than he did before? Because, you know, maybe they knew some of the off-ice issues. Maybe they knew they'd know the person a little more. How much more are teams looking at really getting guys – embedded in Europe.
Radulov's got off-ice issues?
Yeah, not at all.
Really? What?
Yeah. I'll tell you a funny story about Radulov in his draft year. So he's sitting there. I was in the hotel, and he's sitting down. And I said, hey, Alexander Radulov. And he said, no. And I'm like, okay. And I guess he just didn't want to talk. But I was like, all right, yeah, I recognize you. I know you're Alexander Radulov, so you can tell me you're not him if you want to. But, you know, all righty then. So that was one of my one and only interactions with him. But, no, I think to answer that question, Murph, if you look at what NHL teams are doing in terms of investing in the scouting, there are teams out there that are hiring more scouts, that are putting a lot of money into sending more of them out to see as many games as possible. And that investment, I think the idea, it's a good idea, because if you invest in the player drafting and the player development side, it's probably going to pay off for you. in the long run. But you have to make that investment. And I think that the teams that maybe don't do that, well, and I hate to use words like cut corners, but let's just say that, okay?
Yeah.
Teams that kind of cut corners and don't have many scouts and only keep their area guys in their areas, because let's face it, that keeps the infrastructure and costs down on the budget side. You know, if you're not having to pay to send a guy that's based in Ontario out to the West to watch the CHL Top Prospects game, for example, you know, which was mm-hmm. played in BC, mm-hmm. then, you know, you're not paying to send him out. Your costs are down. But now he's not seen any of those players in the CHL Prospects game, so he's missed an opportunity to see more players. You know what I mean? And it's the same thing. If you're not sending players around, or scouts around, and are able to talk to these guys, like you said, in Europe or in BC, you know, a scout that's able to go to Penticton and sit down with Tyson Jost or sit down with Dante Fabro and talk to him a little bit and talk to their coaches about him. Hey, how are they? You know, it was earlier this season, and I won't say who and all of that, but I was in a building before a game with an NHL scout friend of mine, and we were sitting in the head coach's office before the game. And it was after the warm-up skate, you know, and I got to see, you know, what kind of interaction happens, and the scout is just, you know, peppering the head coach with questions. Hey, what about this? How's his work ethic? And what's he doing about that? And I look at his skating. I look at his pivots and transitions. They look a little rough. And the coach is like, yeah, they are. But, you know, check it out. He was, you know, we've mentioned that to him, and he's been putting in the extra work after practice, and we're really impressed with his maturity and leadership. That's the stuff that goes on behind the scenes that the fans don't necessarily pick up on. And if you're not employing your scouts and you're not paying enough of them to go out and ferret out that information, then you're limited when you're sitting there in your scouting meetings and you're trying to determine a list. And I talked about it on one of my blog podcasts, but the difference is, if you have five scouts, okay, and you send five scouts in multiple tournaments and multiple areas, and then another team has five scouts, but only two of the five get to the multiple areas, and the other three are just limited to their geographic region, whether it be New England, whether it be Quebec, whether it be, you know, Western Canada, what have you. The difference between the scouting meetings between the two teams is all five of those other guys are going to be able to have an active debate in the scouting meetings with the chief scout, who's really generating the list for the general manager, versus the other team that only two guys are going to be actively involved in the conversation throughout the process, whereas those other three guys can only get involved when they're talking about players from their region.
Right.
Yeah, getting into back to the interview thing that you mentioned, Murph, this is a much smaller scale, because I don't think this is quote-unquote a bad character kid, but part of the reason that Dougie Hamilton, I think, dropped to the Bruins when he did in the first round, kind of unexpectedly, after the fact and talking to a couple of teams to pick higher the Bruins, was that he did not interview well. And I think teams came away sort of unimpressed by the interviews, and I think that did affect him. And, you know, I think things are working out for him now in Calgary, but it speaks to what, Kirk, mm-hmm. you were talking about as well, with the importance of the investment, especially at that level at the top of the first round in some of these kids.
Right, and that's why I think, you know, you gotta have a good judge of character. You know, some of these kids are very polished and smooth, and they'll tell you exactly what you want to hear. And it's easy to, you know, talk is cheap. You know, show me, don't tell me, as Rush said on the Presto album. And you know,
nice.
it's there's the pop culture, man. Interview me, you're gonna get pop culture. You have to be able to do your homework. So, you know, again, one of my favorite stories, and again, I won't mention the kid's name because I don't want to.
Right.
That's not what I'm about. But I was blown away. I'll say, we'll go back 4 years ago, and I had been watching a kid for, you know, actually the previous couple of years. So I had a really good, solid feel for him even before his draft year in terms of the body of work. And I remember asking the kid what he was most proud of. And the thing that he told me he was most proud of was the one thing that I was banging on him on and I thought was the worst aspect and the biggest thing he needed to improve, and that was his work ethic. And I said to myself, gee, you know, and I said, oh, really? Okay, well, you know, I think that's good because we can always improve our work ethic. You know, there's always work to be done. But I was blown away by the fact that here's a kid who knew that I was going to the games and sitting in the stands and watching him make lazy circles and you know, not stopping and starting very often, and, you know, dominating the first couple shifts of a game and then disappearing the rest of the way, or doing nothing for the first 50 minutes of the game and then popping in and winning the game on the last couple of shifts with some beautiful goals. And I said to myself, how can he think that by telling me that his work ethic's awesome, that I would believe that? And it's the same thing, you know, the NHL teams are the same way. What a lot of these kids don't understand, and someone like Fabbro gets already, is that the NHL teams are asking these kids questions that they already know the answers to, or at least they think they do, okay? And they just want to see if the kid's going to be honest and how genuine they are, and that's the measure of the character. And Fabbro said something to me the other day that really stuck with me and showed me just how much he gets it and how mature and thoughtful he is. And he said, you know, he said, you just have to be yourself. He said that was the biggest lesson he learned at the Combine earlier this month, was you have to be yourself. He said, there's a humility that you have to bring to the table. And he said, and then, you know, teams are either going to like you or they're not going to like you. And if you're trying to conform to what you think the team likes, then you're missing the boat, basically. And that's paraphrased, but it's in the blog article I did on him. But awesome. For a 17-year-old, because he doesn't turn 18 for another 3 days, mm-hmm. but for a 17-year-old to understand that and get that is remarkable. And I think there are more and more kids like Dante that are just kind of, you know, asserting themselves and rising to the top. But teams, you know, the onus is on them to kind of figure it out and understand, you know, do their homework. I keep saying that phrase, but it's a cliche, but it's absolutely true. You know, get as many opinions as you can, get as many scouts in to see them as you can, talk to as many people as you can. But the thing with Fabbro is, no matter who I talk to, it's like a consistent drumbeat. He competes, he's serious, he's mature, he's driven. So I say, well, if it looks like a duck, it waddles like one and it quacks like one, you know, it's probably a duck. So.
Quack, quack.
Bruins fans, they're hoping he's not a duck.
Exactly.
They're hoping he's a Bruin.
So enough of the Dante Fabbro.
I'm ready to sign him to a 10-year, $100 million deal right now.
I mean, there are so many good players, right?
I know. Well, actually, that plays into my question, Kirk, is that at that 14 spot, we talked about some defensemen. Maybe a forward or two that you feel like could be a possibility there. I know there was a lot of and the size on the right wing and the heaviness, I think, plays into that and might be the kind of player they're looking for there. A name that you'd heard a little bit early on was Max Jones, a guy that did not talk to the media at all and left early from the Combine a couple of weeks ago. And it seems like now maybe his stock has started to drop a little bit, bit on Max Jones and just – if there's a forward or two that you think might be taken by the Bruins.
Sure. So at 14, I would have told you even before he bolted from the Combine. That's very curious. I'm not sure what's going on there. And I'm not sure that I care, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, there might be something, you know, beyond that. It'll be interesting to see what the kid says when he's drafted. But I would have told you even then, before then, I would be very leery of Max Jones at 14. I think that's just early for him. Heavy player, absolutely, very good skater. But I don't know that he did enough this season. You know, you got to remember, context. He's playing on a powerhouse team, so the numbers are likely, you know, his offensive numbers and production are going to benefit from being on a team like that. Even though, because it's just, the London was just so deep, they came at you in waves, and anybody that saw London on the first weekend of the OHL season had an inkling that they were going to be in the Memorial Cup mix, because they're just so dominant. Really, all they needed was goaltending, and they got it from Tyler Parsons, who's another draft eligible, by the way. And he's a good player. But getting back to Jones, 14 would have been a little leery of him. However, when the Bruins were picking at 18, I thought Jones would have been, now that's when you start talking about Jones at the sweet spot. Mm-hmm. You know, getting closer to 20 and in the early 20s. I think he would make perfect sense to the Bruins. I don't know if they're high on him or not, but based on what he can do, I would suspect they are. He is a left wing, and they've got some pretty good left wing depth, but again, it comes down not to a need-based pick, but a best player available. Now, you bring up an interesting scenario. If teams are turned off because he didn't do the interview process, you know, are the Bruins one of those teams that are turned off, or do they see that as an opportunity that maybe they get him at 29? If Max Jones is sitting there at 29, boom, take him. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. that's what I would say. You take him. And so it'll be interesting to me. If the Bruins trade that 29th pick, I don't see them trading it early in the process. You know, I see it being a draft floor type of move where they would be sitting there and they might have several players that are on their list and saying, okay, if any one of these guys is on the board here at 29, you know, we're going to hold it. We'll keep the pick, you know, unless a great deal comes along that they're just too good to pass up. But I would be surprised if we see that pick moved here in the next week. If I see it being traded, it would happen where we're sitting there, you know, and the Bruins are on the clock, and then Gary Bettman's going up, we have a trade to announce, you know. The Boston Bruins have traded the 29th selection to...
You forgot the boo in the background.
Buffalo. I'm sure that. But, I mean, that's what I could see happening. So I think you guys are bang on with Jones in terms of, you know, him being in the wheelhouse. But I would be like, you know, if the Bruins call Max Jones's name at 14, I would submit to you there are going to be a lot of other names that are sitting there at 14 that you would, you know, it could be another one of those Kyle Connor type things where you're like, hey, okay, like Jones is a player, but there and with these other guys, I mean, what, you know, but hey, look, this is what the NHL teams get paid to do. So, I mean, again, you have to trust that they have their process and they see something that the rest of us don't. But
is there a forward at 14 you potentially could see, a guy or two that you could see as a possibility there that would be in the correct spot?
Well, I think Kiefer Bellows will be on the board. Another BU kid. Oh, man. And, you know, the bloodlines, you know, and the whole idea of, hey, the Bruins passed on Brian Bellows, but they could get his kid. Mm-hmm. Thought that would be cool. But here's the thing. Bellows, the consistency just hasn't been there. You know, I've seen, you know, he's a Jekyll and Hyde player. Boy, when he's Hyde, and I'm going to use Hyde in the positive sense, and that, you know, he's badass type. Well, I'm sorry, I swore.
Hey, that's all right, Kirk. no worries.
But that's what I'm going to. So when I'm talking about Hyde, I mean the good Kiefer Bellows. This is a guy who's dog on the bone with the puck. He's a beast along the walls. He's knocking guys just out of the way, grabbing the puck, wheeling it to the net. Has an unbelievable NHL caliber release already. I mean, you're talking about puck just comes off the stick like a laser. Goalie doesn't know where it is. It's behind him. You know, I was watching, like, when a kid can beat the goalie from the top, you know, beyond the circle, mm-hmm. and he's beating him clean and there's no screen, it's like, okay, this kid can shoot, you know, because most guys get their production from the high danger areas in between the hash marks, and that's a given. I mean, the closer you are, the better you have, and the advanced stats bear that out. But those exceptional goal scorers, the Patrick Laines of the world, you know, the Alexander Ovechkins, the Corey Perrys, you know, insert any other, you know, gifted goals, the Vladimir Tarasenkos, they can all just beat the goalies cleanly from, you know, the further out because they just have this wicked release, their pinpoint accuracy. The goalie gives them something to hit, and they go out and they hit it. And that's Bellows. I think he can also pass the puck pretty well. The problem with him is when he's Jekyll, he's kind of passive. He's kind of standing around watching the puck, maybe hanging out, cherry picking, looking for someone to go get him the puck and then spring him. And so I think that when you look at the rankings, you know, I haven't seen one list that has Kiefer Bellows in the top 10. And if I had to point to a reason, that would be it. So would he make sense at 14? Sure. I would be fine with him there, but I don't know that the Bruins see the value there at 14 for him. So I saw a guy on Twitter ask about, you know, ask about stud forwards at 14. You know, is he your definition of a stud forward? Well, you know, when he's Hyde, he's a stud, but when he's Jekyll, I don't know. So, again, it's risky, and natural scorers don't grow on trees, but I could see why they would be leery. Now, for me, a stud forward at 14, which I don't think he'd be there, would be Tyson Jost. Mm-hmm. That's a stud forward for me. And if he's there, you're having a hard time passing on him. But a Michael McLeod, for example, not a stud forward to me. I mean, he's an impressive center in that he can skate and think the game very well. But I don't know that he has that offensive element. So, you know, if you're good drafting a third line center at 14, okay, Michael McLeod to me makes perfect sense. I think that's what he is. He's a third line center. Now, if we're talking Logan Brown and he's there at 14, which again, I don't think Logan Brown will be. I think he could go as high as 6 to Calgary. That's just what I have in my latest mock. But Logan Brown at 14 makes perfect sense. Guy's 6'6", can really skate. He's got a high offensive upside. So it's all a matter of context. I think those quote-unquote stud forwards are going to be drafted earlier in that top 14, and that means some of these better defensemen are going to be available, and I think that probably makes more sense for Boston, given the value there.
Yeah, no doubt. Looking less at the draft and more just at the Bruins and the draft last year, in the last couple of years, last year's draft picks, Zboril, DeBrusk, Sinishin, Carlo, JFK, you know, you look at the players that were drafted last year. Yeah. Do you see any of those guys potentially threatening for an NHL roster spot in September and October?
Yeah, I think Brandon Carlo and Jake DeBrusk, just off the top, because they're late 96s, so they can play in the AHL next year. And that's huge. I mean, we're talking difference of options. Now, it's not to say Boston could technically opt to send them back to junior if
right.
they wanted to. They're still eligible to put to overage. But because they were born in 1996 and they turned 20 before January 1st, they can play in the AHL, whereas Zboril and Sinishin cannot because they're 97 players. And that's an important distinction. I get this on Twitter a lot. Fans, they don't understand why can these guys play and these other guys can't. It's just, it just has purely to do with when they were born. And so when you look at a guy with the tools of a Brandon Carlo, for example, 6'5", can really skate. I mean, you guys saw him in training camp last year, in development camp. I mean,
I saw them drop him into the AHL playoffs last year, and he
right,
was perfectly
right.
fine for,
yeah,
for a young
exactly.
kid.
Exactly. So just off the top of your head, you're looking at a guy that even if he doesn't make the Bruins roster out of camp, he's going down to Providence in all likelihood. I don't think even if they he was eligible to be the overager and go back to the WHL, they would send him there. He makes perfect sense to have him in Providence. But let's say he doesn't make the Boston opening night roster. A week later, he could be up in Boston mm-hmm. because someone gets hurt or he plays so well that they're like, forget it. Well, let's get him in here, right? So Carlo, right off the bat, he's a guy. DeBrusk, yeah, a little different situation. He's a 96, but the physical maturation is kind of a question with him. He's not a big guy like his dad was. He's a little lanky and light, so he's got room to add some muscle and physically and mentally. I don't know if the Bruins will see him as ready for the AHL, or they might see value in sending him back for another year of junior, and then the contract doesn't toll. You know, they save a year on that ELC because the second they put him in Providence, then that 3 year entry level deal they're on. So the Bruins have they have options with both players. So I could see Carlo threatening. I wouldn't completely rule Zboril and Sinishin out. I just don't think their games progressed enough, you know, the complete game, to make sense given what everyone on the roster, you know, where the roster stands right now. Other prospects that have more experience and might be a little higher in the food chain. And then, of course, that the X factors of who are the Bruins going to bring in this offseason and who are they going to you know, shepherd out the door. And that's why when people ask me, hey, you know, what's your lineup look like next year? I mean, I really don't enjoy those exercises in May and June and April and earlier because, again, we don't know who the Bruins are going to bring in. So, I mean, I can tell you on June 17th, you know, who might make sense today. But on July 1st, July 2nd, we could see a radical transformation of this roster. So I'm just a fan of waiting to see, you know, what the team is going to look like as we get closer to the start of camp, and then we can start making those projections. And if I had to pick one, Brandon Carlo is the guy because I really like Carlo, and people think I'm down on him. It's not true. I just think that some people might have a little higher expectations for him than what I've seen. You know, excellent shutdown guy and looks like he's going to play in the NHL for years. I just don't know if he has the vision and the creativity to be that true two-way threat. And that's what I think he could maybe develop some of that, but I'm in a wait-and-see mode. But I think he'll certainly play and contribute, and I can understand why people are excited about him.
All right, and since we promised people we'd ask you at least one question on Twitter, I'll throw one at you for a 30 to 45-second scouting report. From Kevin Cassidy, KCassidy63 on Twitter. What do you think of Jacob Chychrun from the Sarnia Sting?
Okay, so starting now, and I'm looking at my clock.
There you go.
Tremendous tools. He's huge, 6'5", skates really well, very good with the puck, confident, makes the crisp outlet pass, has the big shot, you know, can impose his will both offensively and defensively. On the downside, I really question his vision and his overall hockey sense. I see a player who's indecisive at times, downright passive and standing around puck watching when he should be clearing out or going in and getting the puck. I was as big on Chychrun as anyone watching him on film. However, when I saw him live at the under-18s, I saw he was exposed. He was indecisive. He was deferring to Fabro most of the time. They were a pairing together. So I'm not sold on Chychrun as the guy we thought he might be as a franchise cornerstone. I think he's got a high floor and will play in the NHL. But me personally, all this talk of moving up to get him, whatnot, I don't buy it. I don't think he's going to be the player people thought he was a year ago.
Yet he will still be probably gone by the time the Bruins pick at 14, most likely.
I think so, but the conversation will be depending on where he goes. I think he gets personally. I don't think he gets past Buffalo at 8.
No. Personal friends with Terry Pegula and the family that owns the Buffalo Sabres. Usually,
not only that, but you know they're hosting the draft, right? So they want to make a big splash. Chychrun's a huge name, but here's the problem, Hags. Chychrun has been hyped. And the fans are engaged in groupthink with this kid, okay? Most fans haven't ever seen him play, all right? Or they've seen snippets of him, highlights, they go on YouTube. And he's living off of potential that was, you know, and again, I'm not trying to bang on the kid, but this is important. He's living off of potential that was established a year ago, mm-hmm. all right? And in the first couple months of the season. I watched him consistently on film in the OHL the second half of the season, and I saw things I had not seen before. And unfortunately for Chychrun, this is what happens. When you get the scrutiny on you as a high-end draft selection, everyone's looking at you, and you're under the spotlight. But he kind of wilted, and you started seeing mistakes, and you started seeing flaws emerge. So I was really hoping that when I would see him live in Grand Forks that I would be put more at ease, and that some of these things that I saw on film wouldn't manifest. Well, it was worse. Like, it was magnified. I was like, oh, my gosh, you know. These are some serious questions. So I can see if NHL teams are seeing what I did. Now, I might be wrong, and Chychrun might go on to be, you know, the next big thing. But I see comparisons with Ekblad and all of that. I don't know. You know, he's certainly toolsy like that. But the important thing for fans to get is that there's this established acceptance that Chychrun is you know, the best defenseman in the draft. And I don't agree with that at all. And I suspect I'm not alone, and I suspect there are people out there who do think he's the best, and the proof will be in the pudding. But if your team doesn't go trade up to grab a guy like Chychrun, it doesn't mean they messed up, okay? It just means that they didn't see the value there. So I would just caution people about getting into that groupthink, because whoever drafts some Hags, they're going to be patted on the back and declared winners. Mm-hmm. But what I want to see is in 3 or 4 years, where is Chychrun? And I believe he'll be in the NHL. I don't think he's going to be a bust, but I don't think he's going to be this. You know, a year ago we were talking about he's going to be this franchise cornerstone. He's going to be this future number one. He's a guy that if you get him, you're high-fiving and you can pretty much not make another pick the rest of the draft and you still won, kind of thing. And I haven't seen that. Now, I could be wrong, and in fairness to Chychrun, he seems like a really character-quality kid. But I was concerned at how much he was deferring to Fabro, and a lot of times Chychrun would get the puck and he was just passing it over to Fabro, like, here, dude, you take it because you're doing well. You know, that was what it looked like to me. And I was like, wow, I want a guy who's going to take charge and assert himself and impose his will on a game. And Chychrun had opportunities to do that, and he didn't. And look, it was only 4 games, right? Small sample size. But hey, you know, again, if it looks like a duck, quacks like one. I don't know. So.
Well, Kirk, I've known you for 10-plus years. You said you might be wrong on this. You haven't been wrong too many times on the prospects. We thank you very much for the time and appreciate it. All right, Murph, we like to be interactive with the Great American Hockey Show podcast program, so let's answer some Twitter questions. This one is from Russ Ramondini, Golden Pipes on Twitter. If they package players and pick 29 in the first, who could they expect to land? What would it take to get a Hampus Lindholm, in your opinion?
It's going to take a lot more than they have.
Yep.
Plain and simple.
What could they get if they package the first-round pick and, let's say, like a Ryan Spooner? What do you think is reasonable as far as what they could get on the market? I mean, something like that could get a Shattenkirk, maybe?
Yeah, that's right where I was going to go, a Shattenkirk.
Yeah. I mean, anybody else you can think of besides the usual suspects that you feel like is going to get dealt defenseman-wise that they might be in the market for besides Shattenkirk that's in that situation, kind of a one-year rental? Beyond him,
Not off the top of my head.
Most of the ones we're hearing are RFAs, young guys, the way the team might not want to pay them. What do you like Shattenkirk? Would you do that?
I do. I like Shattenkirk. I just think, you know, you had a chance to get him at the deadline with a guy you pretty much are 90% sure you were going to lose. And now to turn around and give up a decent package to get him, I don't know. It's tough to swallow if I'm the Bruins.
All right. One more. Anders Johnsson, 21. Anders Johnsson is his name. Thoughts on signing Radim Vrbata as Louis' replacement? May get him on the cheap with down year and being a right shot moves 63 to left wing. 63 already is a left wing. I don't know what he's talking about there, but go ahead.
I like Vrbata. I think that's a good idea. I mean, it depends, obviously, on what the hit is, what the cap hit is there, but I think he is a guy that could come in and provide some scoring. I don't know if he necessarily fits in with the direction the Bruins are going right now.
If they want bigger, heavier, stronger players on the wing, that's not Radim Vrbata.
Yeah. I mean, he's got size, but he's not heavy.
No.
You know, he doesn't use that size. And also speed, too. I mean, and that's the direction the NHL's going right now, and I don't know. I don't know if he's a good fit. I think he could be had for a good price, but I just don't know if he fits where the Bruins are going.
I also continue to think that maybe Jimmy Vesey is that guy that's going to come in and replace Louis Erickson.
You still think they could get him, huh?
I haven't. My opinion has not changed. I've heard conflicting things from different people. One, on the one hand, I've heard that there are links between the Kevin Miller deal and Jimmy Vesey, and that was a hoop that the Bruins had to go through to sort of, finalize the process, or that was sort of something that, you know, they kind of had to take care of in order to make sure they could get Vesey on the 15th. And it would make some level of sense as to why they signed Kevin Miller to a 4-year, $10 million deal, which defies logic and
reason.
Unless
the agent turns around and screws them.
Well, that could happen too, certainly. And shame on the Bruins if that's exactly what does happen. But the other thing that I've heard, and I've heard this for months, and I know you tweeted that Pierre McGuire said this in Montreal radio yesterday, is that Jimmy Vesey has long been friends with Jack Eichel, that he is going to go play for the Buffalo Sabres and play with Jack Eichel, and that's kind of where he's been leaning, and that he does not want to play in Boston and have all the pressure of, you know, being the savior of the Bruins on his shoulders. He kind of saw the way Jimmy Hayes was treated here over the last year and maybe said, I'm all set with that, and I'm going to go somewhere else where it's going to be a little easier on me. And that makes sense, too. And
the other thing McGuire brought up, though, is very interesting and really can lure him now is the Pittsburgh Penguins. I mean, obviously, when Sidney Crosby's there, that's enough attraction in itself to bring a free agent like that, a young kid there. But now that they've won the Stanley Cup, I mean, and this is a team on the rise with good young players, they could swoop in and get him.
He's not going to the Penguins.
All right.
I don't see it. I don't know. Is Pierre still angling for the GM job at Pittsburgh? Is that why he said that?
I think Pierre's been angling a little more north, right where we're sitting here, if you ask me. But that's a whole other show.
We're going to save that for the next Twitter segment. All right, that's it for this week. Thanks for watching and listening. Thanks to Kirk Ledecky for calling in and talking prospects. We'll do the next podcast after the draft and maybe before free agency when the hot stove is really burning with a fiery vengeance. For now, keep it great, keep it American, and always keep it about hockey. There we go. See you, folks.